Welcome to American Family Focus on Pennsylvania Issues, a weekly program discussing issues of concern to the family and those who hold traditional family values in Pennsylvania and our nation. Archives of these programs can be heard at www.afafpa.org. And now, your host, Diane Gramley, State Director of American Family Association of Pennsylvania.
Back in December, President Obama flew to Paris to meet with other heads of state to discuss the end of the world, climate change. At least in their eyes, the world is in terrible shape because of climate change. Remember, that term has been changed from global warming because apparently the global temperature is not rising like they predicted. Also, they're warning us about the rising ocean levels because of the melting ice caps, which really isn't happening either. The idea of the Paris Accord is that all nations should band together to help each other fight climate change, i.e. first world countries pay for third world countries in their fight against quote-unquote climate change. My guest today is Dr. Calvin Beisner. He is founder and national spokesman of the Cornwall Alliance, former associate professor of historical theology and social ethics at Knox Theological Seminary, and of interdisciplinary studies at Covenant College. He's the author of Where Garden Meets Wilderness, Evangelical Entry into the Environmental Debate, and Prospects of Growth, A Biblical View of Population, Resources, and the Future. Thanks, Dr. Beisner, for being with us.
Well, thank you very much. It's my privilege.
And what is the Cornwall Alliance?
Well, the Cornwall Alliance for the Stewardship of Creation is a network of about 60 scholars sprinkled around mostly North America, though we have a couple in India and some other countries. Roughly a third of us are theologians, philosophers, ethicists. I pretty much fall into that category. And roughly a third are natural scientists, physicists, chemists, geologists, geographers, climatologists, and the like. And then roughly a third also are economists and political scientists, policy experts, and actually I fall partly into the economist group as well, in that my MA is in economic ethics and I've written a couple of textbooks in the field. But at any rate, we are Christian scholars, and we seek to promote through a variety of different educational means three things simultaneously. The first is biblical earth stewardship, or what we also call, picking up on the language of Genesis 1:28, godly dominion, men and women created in God's image, enhancing, working together to enhance the fruitfulness, the beauty, and the safety of the earth to the glory of God and the benefit of our neighbors. Second, economic development for the very poor through a combination of two things. The first one is property rights, entrepreneurship, free markets, limited government, the rule of law, and so on, free trade. And the other is access to abundant, affordable, reliable energy. Without either one of those, no society can rise or stay out of poverty. And then third, we seek to promote the proclamation and the defense of the gospel of Jesus Christ and the Christian worldview in general, and we try to integrate all of these three things together in everything that we do. We create books and hundreds of articles and major study papers. All of these things are on our website, cornwallalliance.org. We also have created a series of videos called Resisting the Green Dragon, and a very recent video called Where the Grass is Greener, Biblical Stewardship versus Climate Alarmism.
And that's what we see is climate alarmism. I think that's a good term for what we see coming out of too many government officials, not just in the U.S., but really around the world, especially in first world countries.
Absolutely.
They seem to have, they don't seem to be concerned about other things. I mean, even President Obama has said that ISIS is not the problem here, really basically he's saying climate change. When we're more concerned about climate change, they're more of a danger. Climate change is more of a danger to the U.S. than ISIS and than terrorists. He sees, that whole thing as more dangerous. Is that just something the so-called progressives view? I don't understand how they reach the conclusions that they reach about climate change. You know, they had to change the name from global warming to climate change because the globe wasn't warming the way that they had predicted. I don't understand how they, you may well not either, but I don't understand how they reach this idea that we have to protect the earth, that climate change is more of a threat to us than terrorists. When we see terrorists cutting off people's heads and blowing buildings up and such.
Yeah, well, I think it varies. The reason for this, I think, very mistaken prioritization of climate risks over things like terrorism or other major threats. I think the reason varies from person to person. Particularly with President Obama, I think it arises at least in part from the very fact that President Obama, right from early in his political career, long before he was ever elected to the Senate even, has embraced a political economic philosophy called neocolonialism. It was taught by his father, who was a Marxist economist from Kenya. And neocolonialism basically says that although the colonial era ended in the 1960s, with various colonies becoming independent of their colonizing countries, their imperial masters, so mm-hmm. to speak, nonetheless, colonialism got extended. It continued in the form of global free trade. And global free trade is really simply imperialism in a different form. And the largest global free trading country is the United States, and so it is the most imperialist country. And therefore, to really truly free the so-called colonies from free trade dominance, you have to weaken the United States and, in fact, all of the other major developed nations, because their trade with smaller nations is what really oppresses them. So I think that Obama actually truly believes this. And so he has intentionally sought to weaken the United States. And when you believe this, you have to think that the people in the third world countries, the developing countries, are the victims. And therefore, you can't think, really, that these terrorists are doing evil things. They're just responding to their victimization. Wow. So he can't really see them as such a threat. He has to say, well, it's really our fault. But with climate change, he has been, whether he's been persuaded, really having thought the issues through himself, or has simply accepted without much critical thinking the alarmist claims of his advisors, I really don't know.
Yeah.
But he certainly touts the message that they give, and that is that human emissions of carbon dioxide, because we burn fossil fuels, are causing global average temperature to rise at a dangerously rapid rate to dangerously high levels that are going to cause all kinds of terrible problems, probably the worst of which would be rising sea level, which, hey, for me, living in South Florida,
yeah,
17 miles inland but only 8 feet above sea level, I would be very concerned if I were convinced that that were a serious problem.
Yeah.
But I'm not.
Yeah, right. And most people along the coast would be. In fact, I just read an article, I think it was out of Great Britain, about there was a doctor of some sort, and he predicted, he was talking about the evolution of man, how man was going to evolve. This became a water world because of global warming. You know, we would get web feet and gills and all this kind of stuff. I mean, you know, it's to the point of lunacy in my book, but anyway, I just don't understand. But I know that
the rate at which this macroevolution supposedly occurs is so terribly slow. I mean, it takes millions of years, that if global warming were happening at a rate anywhere remotely close to that the alarmists claim, evolution wouldn't give us any solutions to
that's
that.
That's for sure.
It would be much too slow.
We'd all be dead by the time we quote-unquote evolved to something.
Yeah,
for sure. But I know that President Obama, back on November 24th, he did announce his plan to deliver a devastating blow to ISIS just days before he left for the talks in Paris. He said, quote, "What a powerful rebuke to the terrorist it will be when the world stands as one and shows that we will not be teetered from building a better future for our children," unquote. That the terrorists aren't going to scare us because we're going to be talking about something more important, and that is climate change, and that's fine.
What a powerful rebuke.
I'm absolutely sure
the terrorists, the ISIS leaders, the Al-Qaeda leaders, the Taliban leaders, the Boko Haram leaders, they all must have just gone, oh, no, this is frightful.
Yeah, shaking in the boots. I'm sure that they were shaking in the boots, yeah. On the end of December, you wrote an article entitled "Never Underestimate Your Opponent, Coming to Grips with the Paris Climate Agreement." Now, we're being told that the agreement is non-binding. Why did you write the article?
Well, really, it was as I reflected more and more on the fact that it was that the agreement was non-binding. I mean, initially, I had thought, oh, this is a good thing. It's a non-binding agreement, therefore we're not going to be legally required to abide by it. But then what I realized is that actually that's precisely why Obama pursued it in this way, because he wants to give the impression that because this is a non-binding agreement, it doesn't need any congressional approval, and therefore he can go about using executive administrative channels to implement this agreement without having to go before the Congress at all. Now, the problem with this, first of all, a lot of the public, I think, has actually embraced that idea, has been persuaded by that. But the reality, I think, is quite different. Very fine legal mind at the Competitive Enterprise Institute, Marlo Lewis, did a very excellent article in which he pointed out that absolutely nothing in constitutional law, nothing in treaty law, suggests that something is a treaty if and only if it is legally binding. And then he goes through various different characteristics of this agreement from Paris and shows that they, in fact, are quite in keeping with what constitutional and treaty law defines as a treaty. Mm-hmm. And so for that reason, we should be looking for Congress, particularly the Senate,
right,
and its advise and consent role, to have to look at this, and if it's not ratified by the Senate, then it isn't binding.
Right.
But what happens is that because so many people have been persuaded that this is not actually a treaty, then it doesn't need Senate ratification, and then Obama is free to use it as a sort of a moral claim. We've made this commitment. We need to do this. Well, the fact is, we haven't made this commitment. We, the people of the United States, make treaty commitments, make international commitments by means of the Senate of the United States with the president, not by the president alone.
And to me, that's the same thing that we see happening with the deal with Iran.
Yes.
He's not involving the Senate. It's just something that he worked out. And, well, basically in this case, Congress gave him the free rein to do whatever he wanted in Iran, the Iranian agreement, plus with the Trans-Pacific Partnership. I mean, more and more we see Congress not doing their job. But you mentioned that he'd be able to use it, even though it's not, quote-unquote, legally binding, that hasn't gone through the Senate, that he would be able to use it to browbeat Congress. Isn't that pretty much what they did with Kyoto? Did we ever ratify Kyoto?
No, we never ratified Kyoto either. And, in fact, in 1997, after the Kyoto meeting at which the Kyoto Agreement was put together, now Al Gore signed that on behalf of the United States as vice president, but that never bound the United States because it was clearly a treaty, and the Senate never ratified it. And in fact, instead, the Senate passed a resolution by a vote of 97-0.
Oh my goodness!
saying that it would not consider any such treaty.
Wow.
That's really precisely why this Paris climate agreement didn't wind up getting submitted to the Senate either. President Obama knew absolutely that there was no way that it would make it through the Senate. He might get a few votes, but certainly not the two-thirds necessary
that
to ratify
need.
A treaty.
Yeah, but yet you still hear about how politicians, liberal politicians who believe climate change is happening, especially I can envision that Clinton's doing this, where they have used the Kyoto Agreement, use that to browbeat some politicians, some legislators, in trying to shame them into passing ridiculous laws that
absolutely.
Would...
And they're using this as the excuse, for instance, for the clean power plan, or what I like to call the cruel power plan, because it will jack up energy prices, particularly electricity prices around the country, hurting people on fixed and low incomes terribly. They try to justify this by saying, well, look, okay, we admit that full implementation of this plan would not make a significant difference in global average temperature by the end of this century. Even the EPA's own calculations say it would be less than 0.02 degrees Celsius reduction in global average temperature.
0.02 degrees in difference in temperature?
Right.
Oh, my.
You can't even measure that, let alone does it have any impact on any life anywhere on Earth. But what they say is, but still, we need to do this because this, you know, we've committed ourselves to leading the fight against global warming. So we have a moral obligation to do this. Well, the truth is that because the Paris Agreement is not legally binding, most of the other countries that have signed it are also not going to perform any of the commitments they've made. And in fact, for the most part, there really are not even any commitments. There are instead statements of intent.
Mm-hmm.
And most of those statements of intent do not involve, particularly for large developing countries like China and India,
right,
which between the two of them have about a third of the world's population, they do not involve actual reductions in their carbon dioxide emissions. They only involve saying, well, sometime after 2030, we'll think about starting to reduce the rate of growth of our carbon dioxide emissions.
After 2030, think about. Oh, wow.
Right.
That's really good.
Yeah.
That's like 15 years from now before they're going to think about it.
Anyway.
That's great.
So the U.S. gets stuck trying to lead when nobody's following.
Exactly.
One almost wishes that President Obama would go back to leading from behind.
Yeah, that's true. That's true. I guess, what was it, last year, President Obama set aside a green climate fund for like $3 billion.
Yeah.
It was a pledge, and it's to help poor countries prepare for climate change. Are poor countries really concerned about climate change? Are they concerned about finding food to eat for the next meal?
Well, surveys, polling around the world shows that people in poorer countries have little to no interest in fighting climate change. Their basic concern is, how can we overcome poverty so that we have enough food to eat, so that we have adequate housing, we have decent medical care, good education, and so on. Well, a major part of the answer to that, and they know this, and their leaders know this, is that you cannot overcome poverty without access to abundant, affordable, reliable energy, especially in the form of electricity.
Mm-hmm.
Well, you cannot get that except in most places. You cannot get that except from either nuclear energy, which the environmentalists generally oppose anyway, and which, by the way, does have the risk of nuclear weapons proliferation in the wrong hands, but nuclear or fossil fuels.
Yeah, right.
And fossil fuels are exactly what they don't want us to use.
For sure.
So the poor countries are not going to commit to that. They realize, their leaders realize, that lifting their people out of poverty is far more important because, frankly, the risk to human health and life that come from poverty are hundreds, thousands of times greater than any risks that come to us from climate.
Yeah, and you mentioned nuclear power as an alternative and the risk involved with that, especially in the wrong hands. But I know that President Obama has been pushing solar and wind power, pushing those big time since he took office. Are those good, affordable alternatives to fossil fuels?
No, they certainly aren't, and there's a fundamental physics reason for why, and that is that they are extremely low density. That is, their energy density is very low. So the result is you have to occupy a huge amount of land, whether with wind turbines or with solar panels, in order to capture a little bit of energy.
Mm.
And then the process of concentrating that energy into electricity is quite expensive, much more expensive than the process of concentrating the already very dense, concentrated energy in coal, oil, and natural gas into electricity.
Yeah.
So now, whereas wind and solar can make sense in some limited, fairly small areas, in order to provide electricity for a large electrical grid, the kind of grids that are standard throughout developed countries and without which industries cannot thrive, for providing that kind of electricity, wind and solar simply are very expensive and they are unreliable because they're intermittent.
Mm-hmm.
You know, the sun's not shining
average
12 hours a day, and it actually shines well enough for good solar power generation only about 5 or 6 hours a day.
Wow.
The wind isn't always blowing. So as a result, you have intermittent provision of power to the electric grid, which results in brownouts or blackouts, and those destroy industrial equipment, especially highly fragile electronic equipment. They can be very expensive, and they can threaten people's lives.
Yeah.
In order to try to prevent that, you have to back up the wind and solar with coal or natural gas-powered plant. But those plants have to be run at what's called spinning reserve. It's a slow process, and that's very inefficient, and it actually puts out more carbon dioxide than running them at high speed.
Yeah, wow.
So you have to pay for the wind and solar and for the coal or natural gas plants, which means you're really buying electricity twice. It's like being told you have to have two cars, one that will operate whenever you want it to, and one that operates every once in a while.
Yeah, that makes sense. I know that as I've driven through West Virginia, there's several. I can think of this one place in particular, and I can't tell you exactly where it is in West Virginia, but the whole hillside is full of windmills, you know, like these giant windmills, as well as down in Somerset County here in Pennsylvania,
yes.
Just around the, actually near the Flight 93 crash site. They're just fields full of windmills, and then there's a farm. I remember a farm down in Lancaster County, Pennsylvania, where the fields are just, there's this one field that is full of solar panels. And
one of the really ironic things is that it's environmentalists who are pushing this, which really, I think, reveals that real care for the beauty of the environment is not nearly so much a concern for them as the rolling back of industrialization,
mm-hmm.
the impoverishment of Western civilization,
yeah.
because these things are ugly as all
get
out.
Yeah.
And by the way, they kill literally millions of birds and bats,
many of them endangered. Yeah, I know that. And I think it was in England several years ago where they'd been into really big into wind power, where they've started taking down some of those big windmill things because they just don't produce the power that they had been led to believe they would produce.
Yeah,
and,
they also, what they do, though, produce is what's called fuel poverty or energy poverty.
Hmm.
Britain pursued a very strong policy of trying to replace fossil fuel plants with wind and solar, especially wind. The result was rapid increases in electricity prices, and that pushed lots of Britons into what they learned to call fuel poverty. Basically,
mm-hmm.
they can't afford both to buy the food they need and to heat their homes
wow.
in the cold of winter adequately. So the rate of what epidemiologists call excess winter deaths skyrocketed.
Oh, wow.
The winters of 2009-10 through the winter of, well, even into this current winter, with an extra average of about 7,000 to 10,000 excess premature winter deaths happening each of those winters, driven by the fact that their energy prices were driven up by their renewable energy policy.
And they could not afford to heat their homes.
They're backing off of that a little bit anyway.
Wow. Now, and they couldn't afford to feed their to heat their homes and eat. So they
chose
didn't.
To eat and
yeah.
they froze.
Right. Oh my goodness. 7,000 to 10,000 maybe each of those years in Britain.
Yeah. Extra.
Extra death. Right. Right. Extra death.
Winter death.
Wow. That says a whole lot right there. What can the ordinary citizen do to combat this lunacy? I mean, there's even talk of,
well,
you know, arresting those who don't agree with climate change and all this kind of stuff. It's lunacy. So,
yeah, Senator Sheldon Whitehouse of Rhode Island, a Democrat, proposed prosecuting people like me who question the reality of dangerous man-made global warming. I don't question that human activity has something to contribute. I just question whether it's dangerous.
Yeah. Yeah.
But he's suggested that they ought to be prosecuted under the RICO, or Racketeer Influenced and Corrupt Organizations statutes, which were made to target the mafia, organized crime.
Right.
You know. This is, of course, a serious threat to First Amendment rights,
mm-hmm.
the freedom of speech and the press, as well as to intellectual freedom and the
right.
scientific process, which requires intellectual freedom. But what can the ordinary citizen do? Well, for one thing, he can learn about these things, and the Cornwall Alliance for the Stewardship of Creation is just loaded with excellent resources about this at cornwallalliance.org. And then they can communicate their thinking on this to their elected representatives. And there are a couple of different ways that we've provided to do that. One is a very brief petition called Forget Climate Change, Energy Empowers the Poor.
Mm-hmm.
And if people go to cornwallalliance.org, they will find right on the home page a small box that they can click into to link to that petition and sign it there, add their name. Then we also have an open letter on climate change to the American people and their elected representatives that's been signed already by hundreds of outstanding scientists and other scholars, but we welcome lay people to sign that as well. And these help to express our intent. And as we do this, our elected representatives in Congress and in state governments and so on get to recognize where the people are on these things. And thank God, America is a democratic republic,
mm-hmm.
and the citizenry really can move the thinking and the voting of our elected representatives. This is a way to do it.
Yeah, we need to absolutely, like you said, become more educated. And I do encourage folks to go to your website, cornwallalliance.org, because as you said, there are a lot of good articles, and that should be the first step, is to first become educated on the issue, and your website is the best way to do that, because there's the mainstream media is definitely out there pushing the idea of climate change and the end of the world is coming, et cetera, et cetera. But becoming
educated.
We
also have a Facebook page, by the way, Cornwall Alliance for the Stewardship of Creation on Facebook, and very active there, lots of good interaction, so people can learn many things there as well.
Okay, so cornwallalliance.org, and you're also on Facebook, and I do encourage our listeners to go to both those places and check it out, and I thank you so much for being with us and explaining this whole situation. Like I said, lunacy in my book. But
thank you, and God bless.
And God bless you. Okay, take care.
You have been listening to American Family Focus on Pennsylvania Issues. If you would like to get involved in the efforts to defend traditional values in Pennsylvania, please contact the AFAFPA by writing to Post Office Box 1048, Franklin, Pennsylvania, 16323, or by visiting their website at www.afafpa.org.